You're listening to Community Radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is KWTF. And now another presentation of Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Albert Big Man Howard.
I know flowers grow for rain, but how can love grow for pain? Ain't that peculiar? A peculiar attitude. Ain't that peculiar, baby? Peculiar as can be. Oh, you tell me lies that should be obvious to me. But I'm so much in love. That things you do and say are designed to make me blue. It's a doggone shame my love for you makes all your lies seem true. If the truth makes love last longer, why do lies make my love stronger?
This is Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Albert Big Man Howard, here at KWTF Community Radio. We're going into the 11th chapter of Martial Law, the story of Marshal Eddie Conway. And our readers today is David Ingle, Don Campos, and your host, Albert Big Man Howard. So please stay tuned. There was an intelligence network that operated throughout the entire infrastructure in the Maryland House of Corrections. Through this network, I had learned that two operatives had been placed in the prison to investigate the organized crime activities. One of these people was a federal agent who was placed undercover among the population, and the other was an officer from headquarters who was posing as a rank-and-file guard. The target of this investigation was the godfather of the criminal organization in the prison and his immediate underlings. This had no bearing on the work that I was doing at the time, which involved organizing around issues that affected lifers and trying to change criminal justice policies in Annapolis. I set up a meeting with the Godfather, a man I knew personally. We had a long history of imprisonment together. He and most of the men who were in leadership in the criminal organizations were serving life sentences. I was unhappy about his lack of concern for issues that were affecting the prison population, and more specifically, those that were having an impact on the lifers. Some year prior, a man serving a life sentence was out on work release, one of the few programs that were available to lifers, when he had killed his common-law wife and himself in a domestic dispute. The governor at the time, Paris Glendinning, in a reactionary move, then decided to shut the program down and return those lifers back to the prison. Immediately after this happened, several of us attempted to hire a lawyer to correct the situation before it became codified. Lifers throughout the system were attempting to raise $25,000 to cover the legal fees, but we were only able to raise together $13,000. This shortfall was due largely to the fact that the drug mob was sucking so much money out of the system while telling prisoners not to support the effort because it was bad for their business. Their hope was to make money, make enough money, to get themselves out, and they really didn't care about the rest of the lifer population. As the meeting approached, I was reminded of another conflict that had been recently surfaced. Charlie Duggar, a grassroots activist from Baltimore, had requested our financial support. Duggar had a van that he used to transport at-risk youth for outings, and it needed some work. He had been coming to the prison to support our program for years and had worked with young black men in the community for an even longer period. However, by the time Charlie had asked for our help, the administration and drug mob were controlling where prisoners' funds could go. The funds for prisoners' welfare, which came from the profits earned through the commissary and other pictures and taken pictures, were supposed to be used by prisoners to better their condition and support community programs. So we requested official support for Charlie's program from these funds. It started out that the money that could have gone to support Charlie's efforts had actually been used to sponsor a party for the warden at the request of other members of the drug mob. After this, many of us were disgusted that we developed our own support funds from outside community programs, like a Black Girl Scout troop in West Baltimore. Despite this history, I knew that I needed to get the Godfather to let the Godfather know what was happening, because the impact of the federal government's operation would certainly have an impact on us all. I spent over an hour explaining the situation as I understood it and suggesting a possible course of action. My main motivation was that some of the younger brothers that I had been working with had ties to the drug mob, and none of us wanted them to get caught up in that dragnet. Time passed, and no immediate changes were made in the activities of the criminal organizations. So I made another attempt to reach out and warn them of approaching to warn them by approaching the underlings. Imagine my surprise when they said that they did not even know that they were under investigation. the Godfather had never told him. Some of these men trusted me and quickly ceased their activities. As for those who continued, well, many of them were caught up in the ensuing raid. These men were shipped off to other prisons, shipped off to other states, and several guards were also fired. The Maryland House of Corrections were locked down for several months, and all activities and programs came to an immediate halt. It would be nearly 3 years before we were able to get positive programs started again.
This is David Engel reading from Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. This is Chapter 14, Free Agent. The demands two people make upon each other can be crippling and destructive. No matter how much they love each other, the values of our society conspire to add intolerable pressures to a binding relationship. Huey P. Newton, Revolutionary Suicide. Imprisonment does not end life, it simply makes it more difficult. The cycles that are essential to life continue, as if unaware of the barriers that razor wire presents. Birth, death, and love, all of these things continue uninterrupted because we have no real control over them. While life's joys remain elusive, the pain that most people experience is actually intensified when one resides in a 6x9 steel cage. Not only have I experienced the birth of my grandchildren from this place, I've watched an entire generation of children be born and grow up in the years that have passed since my initial incarceration. Two of my nephews have shared this same address on occasion. The truth is that the complications of life keep right on coming. Often it is only the responses that are different. And sometimes not. Before I was locked up, I pursued women with the same intensity as any man in his 20s would do. My marriage had become the victim of its own premature existence, and though I was still married, I viewed myself as a free agent, and I participated in my share of gratuitous sex. My freewheeling lifestyle eventually resulted in an unplanned pregnancy for a woman I had been loosely involved with. Well, given the environment at the time and the fact that men and women alike were enjoying a sexual freedom that had never before existed for us, I didn't believe that this child was mine. It would be over a decade before I would come to accept this child, Deshaun, as my son. It was really only after he himself became a father to twin girls that I would try to establish a stronger relationship with him. The past can never be changed, but we have a say in the future. I have always tried to maintain a relationship with my oldest son, Ronald, who has also made me a grandfather with the birth of his sons, Jinal and Jabari Marshall Conway. Had circumstances been different, I would certainly have had more children, and over the years, I have mentored many young people because I believe that this is our best chance as a community to change the conditions that have hampered us for so long. Prison has the ability to capture the body much the same way that slavery did, and it is especially important to emphasize the fact that it is the black body that is so often caught within this system. This prison odyssey has given me insight into what it must have been like to be a slave. Separation from family and community, along with the sense of powerlessness, define the last 40 years of my life. Presently in this country, there are well over 2 million people within the prison system who are experiencing this same isolation, and their incarceration is not so much for the purpose of rehabilitation as it's for the profit of others. 200 years ago, these guards would have been slave catchers. The unavoidable space that exists between me and my loved ones is the harshest of all the conditions that imprisonment presents. The inevitable criminalization of family and friends who have to contend with visits that include drug-sniffing dogs, inhospitable guards, and metal detectors is yet another. The shifty, sneaky nature of sexual liaisons with your woman, behind open doors, under tables, or simply on the fly, if at all, is still another condition of confinement. The sex is so desperate that there is little of the erotic or sensual left to an act that may involve two people, but is dictated by necessity, may be witnessed by several. Neither is it pornographic, because we as people of African descent often hold the memory of a past fraught with physical longing and desperation, satisfied on the dirt floors of the crowded slave quarters, or in the fields beyond the cotton. Then and now we live our love silently, fearful that openness will make us vulnerable. This is the reality for the imprisoned and the new Underground Railroad. There is no shame in this. Why should we have shame? The real obscenity lies in the fact that the U.S. is imprisoning an entire nation within itself. Drugs have become the pole that many African-descended people slide up and down daily, only to be saddled with court-appointed lawyers all too eager to dance in the lap of a system that is inherently racist. Pimping is easy when you have 4 centuries of experience with it. While my children know me as a father, it is regrettable that they also know me as a prisoner. These bars are as much a part of my identity as curly hair. My younger sisters barely know me at all, and mostly as a prisoner. No matter how free I remain in my spirit, physical imprisonment is still a part of my reality. Yet I am someone's brother, father, friend, son, lover, and teacher. And no prison can change that. I assume these roles gladly, because this is what preserves my humanity. The experience of having family members who are absolute strangers, you know they exist but do not know them, is much like the experience of the auction block. Many suggest that this fragmentation of community and family is a symptom of modernization, but for me it is more about the literal barriers, the steel and the concrete, the rural locations of these places of holding, not to mention the economics of making those trips. The system constantly recreates the experiences of our ancestors. Prisoner, family, and community all seem powerless to change what amounts to a truly destructive system. I can't help but wonder what will be the ultimate cost to these communities, whose residents are already overcome by post-traumatic stress of slavery and the terror of lynching. And who's going to pay when the bill comes due? These questions remain, yet each individual has dominion over his or her own mind and spirit, as is evidenced by the resistance of our ancestors to the system that enslaved them. In Soledad, Brother, Brother George Jackson speaks of the individual who is completely unfettered by circumstances, and it is in that spirit that I have remained the free agent, the individual who refuses to let prison imprison his mind. The day I walked into the visiting room at the Maryland Penitentiary and saw my father, I knew that something was wrong. His presence told me that things were out of sorts, because the last time I had seen him was now more than 20 years prior. That previous visit, now so long ago, had been one that I would never forget, because by day's end my life would be further altered, even more than the barriers and prison walls had already changed me. It had been soon after my sentencing. The day had come, just like the rest for the last 2 years. The sun arose almost as if it were a burden, and the weight of it brought an oppressive heat into the prison. For me, this had been just another day to get through, knowing full well that I didn't earn the shit that had been heaped onto me. Innocence had been of no consequence to the court, and now I had the rest of my natural life, plus 30 years, to profess it. Not even the blistering sun could have been more bothersome, or so I thought, until my father showed up to inform me that he could not visit me there ever again. He assured me of his love and support, but said that he could not bear the weight that came with walking into that place. I had a genuine love for my father and he for me, and I understood how hard my imprisonment was on others. Visiting is hard, not only is it difficult to leave when the time comes, but the conditions that loved ones are subjected to can be a strain. Visitors are often treated with suspicion and sometimes made to feel like criminals. I understood his decision, and over the years my father's absence from my life became, if not acceptable, then at least less painful. In truth, I knew that my father was of a different generation. Dad's generation had been the great-grandchildren of enslaved Africans. They grew up during the Great Depression and went on to fight the Germans and Japanese during World War II. Men like my father had come back filled with the expectation that life would be different for them and their children. But much like their newly emancipated ancestors, they met racism and rejection, and sometimes the end of a rope. But this did not end their quest for the American dream. Many of them learned to get along, to get over, and Dad was no different. He settled into a job with the city that allowed him to put food on the table, clothes on our backs, and party on the weekends. Rather than reject the status quo as I would later do, he was becoming a part of it, at least to the degree that a colored man could. Dad sought upward mobility, and I am certain that every time he stepped into the prison, he felt the reality of oppression closing in on him. He had spent much of his military stint in the Navy on shore patrol, and his sympathies did not lie on this side of the bars. Injustice and innocence aside, it was difficult for him to reconcile himself to seeing his only son in prison. I believe he was ashamed of my imprisonment, as much as some of the descendants of those enslaved Africans had been ashamed of slavery. 2 decades later, when I found myself sitting across from my father once again, I could not be happy because I sensed that there was trouble. His appearance struck me immediately. Never a very big man, he had always been a thick man, not this fragile person now sitting before my eyes. I knew instantaneously that he was dying. Had to be. The surprise visit alone had alerted me in ways that words could not. Nothing else would bring him into the prison visiting room. This was, after all, the place that had put a permanent wall between us, father and son, all those years ago. That is what prisons do. Wall off all normal human relationships and interactions, completely changing family structures and personal behavior. My father sat across from me, his face my face, making me consider my own future. We greeted each other warmly that day, but in the stiff manner of two people who no longer really know one another, yet are connected in ways that are unseen and unspoken, father and son. I waited, knowing already, even without that closeness, that his very presence represented goodbye. Despite the hopefulness that I felt and the feeling that so much space was suddenly being filled in, I was looking at a ghost. My father died within the year. I was permitted to attend the funeral. It had been some 23 years since I was last uptown, but I was now seeing Baltimore from the grieving eyes of a son whose father had long ago gone missing, from the eyes of a man denied his freedom for 2 decades. My family buried him, and perhaps a piece of me, for certainly I had lost so much in all that time that we did not see each other. In my spirit, I felt the loss of my father so deeply that it brought up memories that were not mine exclusively, memories of men, women, and children forced to march over land toward a destiny that held nothing more than an empty yesterday, but guaranteed one thing, that they would never again see those they had left behind. For them, there was no care about what tomorrow would bring, because their days had been hard enough and the night would be worse. I imagined people exhausted yet unable to sleep. They lay under the stars, minds filled with thoughts of the child pried away from loving arms, the husband or wife who would return from the fields to find a permanent absence, or the parent who would no longer stroke a brow or whisper a word of comfort. The same sky covered them all, and it would be the only thing that kept them connected, the sun, the moon, and the stars. Years later, the loss of my mother would rekindle these thoughts. Disappearances have been an ongoing experience for people of African descent for the last 5 centuries. Relationships, you see, are often the one thing that keep prisoners going, yet they are also the one thing that makes them most vulnerable. This is evidenced by the prison administration's use of Family Day as a leveraging tool when they want to implement changes. If the prisoners buck when they are told they will no longer be allowed to wear street clothes, the administration pulls out their trump card, no family day. The change is implemented without incident because there is no inclination to resist among this newer generation of captives. In the last few years, I have grown weary of these institutionalized occasions and don't participate, though I still look forward to regular visits with my family and friends. I have had a few loving relationships with women since my incarceration. These relationships were both functional in the sense that we were comrades, and some were based on a mutual and long-term friendship. While I was at the Maryland Penitentiary, I entered into a revolutionary marriage. This was an arrangement of convenience. I was estranged from my first wife, Kay, at the time, and with the ever-present threat of being placed on lockdown, I needed someone who could visit me in the event that this occurred. A sister comrade and I were united for this purpose. The relationship was not consummated, nor was it intimate in an emotional way. She was involved with someone else at the time, and so was I. This ruse went on for about a year until the bride suddenly up and disappeared. Sometime in 1975, I entered into a relationship with a woman that would last into the next decade, and this would become my first significant intimate relationship as an adult. Even after the relationship ended, we would remain friends. Though I had previously been married, I had yet to experience anything beyond that adolescent infatuation that always seemed to wane. I had often felt guilty about how I had treated Kay when we were together. When she was pregnant with Ronald, she would come across town to visit me, and I would not even bother to see her safely home at night. Yet I know I was not very different from many other young men my age. I was not equipped to handle a serious relationship, nor was I willing to commit. This new relationship was different, perhaps because of the seriousness of my situation, but also because I was more mature and open than I had been while with Kay, though still not enough to let myself go entirely. That kind of openness would not come for many more years, and until that time, I would frequently find myself entering into relationships simply to maintain some level of humanity. I didn't invest myself emotionally in these relationships, and while it would be easy to say that this was the result of my imprisonment, that would not be completely true. Before I met Kay, I had fallen for a young woman who promptly broke my heart, and this experience would color my relationships for some time to come. I simply did not trust anyone enough to open up, and this, coupled with the vulnerability that a prisoner experiences, made it difficult to let go and love freely. Yet, in the early 80s, I began another relationship, and even though I knew going in that I could not give my heart, I agreed to this situation because it was based largely on a mutual need for support. I had come to a point in my life where I felt consumed by anger, and my new partner had recently gone through the dissolution of a long-term relationship. So we agreed to be there for each other, and though this was a supportive and caring situation, the relationship would eventually end as we simply grew apart. I have often been alone, but never really lonely, so I can't say that any of these relationships occurred at times when I was especially vulnerable, though incarceration makes one vulnerable in ways that may not always be obvious. I have always been intent upon not becoming too involved because of the understanding that a relationship in this place could leave me even more vulnerable, and I had always been elusive where commitment was concerned anyway. Marriage never actually meant fidelity to me, yet I never used the cover of politics to excuse my dalliances. I simply had not met a woman with whom I could fully commit. It would take two more decades and another relationship to finally break down my resistance. For over 30 years, I spent my time loving from the distance that time, that is, prison time, produces, and then one day that space just melted along with my heart. For the most part, I had passed these years by organizing and working to address issues within the prison, and as a result, my relationships with women had been mostly one-dimensional. However, sometime around the 32nd year of my imprisonment, there occurred a shift in my life. I can't help but believe that it was spiritual in nature because I finally fell in love. This love felt like a reward, compensation for decades of injustice. Only freedom could be sweeter, and though I never thought I would be happy, I have found happiness in the form of a woman I shall call Leah. I have not felt anything akin to this since I was a lovesick teen pining away over my first love. After years of seeing women who had grown hard through the struggle, I welcomed the feminine presence that Leah presented. It hid a strong will and an intelligent mind. Leah is a reluctant warrior who fights a good fight, but one who would rather be somewhere passing out flowers. As in the case of most of my relationships, I prefer not to state her true name to protect her privacy. My case has always generated a certain amount of infamy, and though some people have been attracted to me because of it, Leah is a very private person who shies away from the public eye. So much of my life has been lived publicly because of my imprisonment that I now relish the thought of having someone in my life who also craves a quiet moment. Her strength and commitment brought hope back into my life, and with that hope, she introduced me to new experiences. I learned to appreciate the music of Marvin Gaye, especially the song If I Should Die Tonight, because it summed up my feelings about this woman and our relationship. The part where Marvin asks how many men have seen their dream come true captured my attention. I knew that this was my dream in the flesh. The poetry of Langston Hughes began to spill from my mouth as if I were possessed by the writer himself. Leah and I often have spirited debates about politics and culture while sharing our life's experiences with one another. I am left to wonder how one so young has become so wise, and am not afraid to admit that after so many years of mentoring others, I finally found a mentor. Her life has inspired me, and I began to concentrate on gaining my freedom again, for this woman caught me at a time when I was beginning to lose sight of it. I had been struck by the realization that I had always been the driving force behind the campaign for my freedom, telling people I had known for 30 years what to do and how to do it, while feeling like they should have known what to do themselves. It was becoming exhausting, and though I was proud that it had taken so long to exhaust me, I finally threw my hands up and said enough already. This was a constant cycle that I was repeating, reinventing the wheel for political activists who should have known better. When it comes to political prisoner cases, activists and supporters can, and do, walk away and stay away for 2 or 3 years, only to return as if no time has passed. For the political prisoner, however, this is an additional 2 or 3 years of suffering in the belly of the beast. My time as a political prisoner has also involved the burden of being a sympathetic ear to people who come into my orbit under the political pretext, but then unload their own tragedies, both real and imagined. I have always been the type of person that people have sought out to discuss their problems and issues because I am an empathetic individual, but I have perfected the art of remaining emotionally divorced. I listen to people with a critical ear and render advice without taking on the issues of others. I was beginning to feel as if I would never be physically free of prison. But then this woman came from nowhere and opened me up like a vein, and I saw my freedom on the horizon again. Leah not only sparked new interest in my case, she befriended and encouraged my family. Where my approach to relationships had been very distant with other women, I was now guilty of thinking in possessive terms. For the first time, I was interested in a relationship, and I didn't care if it lasted for a day or a lifetime. What was important to me was that I was experiencing something that I knew would not come my way again, and the pursuit was more important than where I would end up. True love is like that. Other relationships had been about reciprocity. I got something and so did she. The terms were always clear, but I never gave my heart. Nor had I intended to, once I had crossed that threshold into this place. But it was as if someone had suddenly held a mirror up, and I was confronted with what I had missed by refusing to look into the glass for so long. What I missed. I had never let my guard down in any of my relationships. I never opened up and shared my deepest thoughts and desires. I was destined to take so much to the grave, but Leah stepped in, and I knew that I had finally found someone who could shoulder some of the burden. The two of us are spirits that have finally reconnected over time and space, participating in that struggle for freedom that continues into consecutive generations. There is no pretense about it. We both understand our purpose and, in our own ways, work to make a difference in the world. When you understand your destiny, there is very little else to do but meet it. I know that this is the woman with whom I am destined to dance, and that each of us had simply been stepping on the toes of others until finally we crossed one another on the floor. This relationship presents challenges for me, for no one has ever demanded as much from me as Leah, and she refuses to give in to the walls by tempering her demands. It is a beautiful situation because she pushes me to fight for my freedom while providing the motivation for it. Prisoners tend to avoid depth in their relationships because they make us vulnerable. This became clear to me one day when Leah told me about a situation that had occurred one evening. She had car trouble, and it was getting late, and she could not reach anyone for assistance. I felt absolutely powerless. Despite the fact that I have been in prison for nearly 4 decades, I have never really felt an absolute sense of powerlessness before, because I never allowed myself to love like this before. I am not so sure that I am worse for the loss, because this relationship has opened up wounds that are older than my experience. At the same time, I get through the days on a different sort of rhythm now, no longer dancing the solemn dance of the man alone. Life involves less of the clanging of doors, the shouts from other prisoners, work, food, and the other mundane details of day-to-day existence. Instead, it is filled with the sound of her voice, her words on paper, and the knowledge that I have found something that transcends this environment, this time. Freedom is more than a fleeting thought. It is something that I see in my future. While I have spent most of my life in prison, I do not see it ending here. The last 2 decades of my imprisonment have been spent organizing programs and mentoring younger men, many of whom will go back into the community. In the early 90s, I found myself in a continual cycle of anger and frustration. It was 20 years into my life sentence when it occurred to me that I had lost 2 decades of my life. This time had been fraught with the abuse and violence from the guards that go hand in hand with the repression of imprisonment. The stress was beginning to show. I was frequently short-tempered and always disagreeable. Realizing that I was headed for serious trouble, I found support among other prisoners in a therapeutic group setting. I soon began to realize that I had never grieved for the loss of my physical freedom. I had been in survival mode for 20 years, with little time for reflection, yet I had lost so much, and suddenly it was all hitting me at once. Around this time, I was also diagnosed with high blood pressure, and this did not come as a surprise, since the everyday life of an African-descended man can be stressful enough. Add to that the experience of imprisonment, and you have the makings of a stroke. I knew that this was serious, and I had to do something, for I had already seen Jackie Powell, one of my co-defendants, die in prison. Jackie had died of an angry and busted heart. He had never quite accepted his fate, and it kept him mad all the time, until finally it just killed him. I did not want to go that way. I realized that I needed to develop some coping strategies. By this time, I had read nearly 2,000 books, most of them dealing with the experience of African-descended people and struggle. I was rigid and needed to balance my political self. I began to explore religion and also found some relief by reading science fiction. I have also been involved in the pursuit of justice for the numerous victims of the FBI's infamous counterintelligence program. In 2006, I drafted a resolution that was introduced to Congress by Representative Cynthia McKinney. Unfortunately, she lost her congressional seat, and the resolution never made it beyond the introduction. I also realized that if I am to be free, it will be up to me to make it happen, and in the last few years I have begun to work with my supporters to pursue my freedom more aggressively. During the past decade, I have had the opportunity to work with Professor Dylan Rodriguez and his students at the University of California, Riverside. I have facilitated lectures on COINTELPRO and the Black Panther Party, in addition to participating in interviews conducted by the students as part of their research. When the pictures of New Orleans residents stranded on rooftops after the levees broke in August 2005 began to anger members of the prison population, some of us came together to organize a fundraiser. We collected non-perishable items and $1,000 in cash, which is quite significant given that prisoners make only a dollar a day. The money purchased gas cards for the Common Ground Collective, an organization started by former Panther Malik Rahim after Hurricane Katrina. Organizing is my life's work, and even though I initially balked at becoming a prison organizer, that is where most of my work has been done. Family and friends tell me I have influenced hundreds of young people, but I don't know. I simply see the error of this society's ways up close and feel compelled to do something about it. I have tried my hardest to avoid getting caught up in the cult of personality that often develops around political prisoners. I have walked the prison yard and seen admiration in the eyes of others, but had to remind myself as I straightened my posture that it is about something bigger than me. Prisons are the place where society dumps those who have become obsolete, and at present there are perhaps no other people who have become more dispensable in this country than African-descended people. The minute that we began to stand up and hold this country accountable for the many wrongs done to us, the prisons began to swell with Black women and men. It is as if the entire justice system is a beast that consumes Black bodies, and prisons are the belly.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Elbert Big Man Howard, accompanied there by the music of the great and late Marvin Gaye. Also reading was David Engels. That finishes Martial Law from Eddie Marshall Conway. We will be back next time with an epilogue to this book by Marshall Eddie Conway and Dominique Stevenson. So make sure you check out the book. Perhaps pick it up at your local bookstore. It's Martial Law by Dominique Stevenson and Marshall Eddie Conway. You're listening to Community Radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is KWTF. Go to our website for more information, how to donate, or to become a volunteer. KWTF.net. A little more music to take us out for this edition of Voices from Behind the Walls.
Up and down in Pennsylvania, where I was a world.
off the assembly line. Yeah, well, they've got me looking everywhere, but I ain't too proud of what I find. And you can't name where I ain't been down, 'cause there ain't no place I ain't been down. I was down in Kansas City, where even the blues sells by the pound. And I've been down in New York City, brother, and that ain't no place to be down. Yeah, I'm looking at the face of the children. You see, we're looking for a higher ground. And you can't name where we ain't been down, 'cause there ain't no place we ain't been down. We fell down somewhere between the cities and the towns. We went down, oh, between the smiles and the frowns. They call me in the morning, I may not recognize the sound, 'cause you can't name where we ain't been down. There ain't no place we ain't been down.
This is Community Radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is KWTF. Coming up next, 2 hours of the best hip-hop in the North Bay. It's Stand Out with A.D. Breathette.